Hello, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. I'm Anastasia, an AI and cybersecurity professor and entrepreneur and the creator of the AI Romy and Robby series. My program, AI Snacks with Romy and Robby, translates AI and robotic technologies from difficult to easy to understand, and it is a show for AI muggles, not wizards. Today, I am bringing again to the studio Dimitri Fischer. Dimitri holds 14 patents in AI and data science. He has a PhD in physics from the Weizmann Institute, and currently he's a senior VP at iCadium. Dimitri is an expert in data science, machine learning, robotics, and computational neuroscience. And he joined his current employer, iCadium, after a very successful career at the Brain Corporation, where he led the development of large-scale emergent vision models and INZ for sensor motor learning and cognition algorithms. Our episode today is all about computer vision. So what is computer vision and how has it evolved? What are current applications of computer vision technologies? What kind of ethical considerations might they be when we consider deploying computer vision? And what could we explore in the near future when we want to improve computer vision technology? So those are the questions which we will discuss today. And now let me bring Dimitri Fischer. And it is my pleasure to welcome Dimitri Fischer again into the studio. Dimitri, very, very nice to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Anastasia. It's a great pleasure. It's always a great pleasure talking with you.
And without further elaborations, let's jump into the computer vision technologies. And could you please explain in simple words, what is computer vision and how has it evolved since its inception?
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a great question. So, computer vision or artificial vision is the ability of artificial systems, computers, in a very broad sense, to acquire and process and act upon image data or video data, any kind of visual input. So, a simple example that everyone uses nowadays is a camera on a smartphone, and the smartphone itself being able to take images, take videos, adjust focus, detect faces, detect QR codes, apply filters, do image search, caption them more or less accurately. Sometimes that's not very accurate, but that's expected. Sometimes it's very accurate. Self-driving cars is another one, more complex because that requires real time, that requires multiple cameras and other types of sensors to see and navigate the environment. That's quite a bit more complex. So that's computer vision. Vision in non-biological systems. And to the second part of your question about the history of how it emerged, it didn't really start at a single point of origin, or it sort of came together from at least three very different directions. So, if you think about the pre-World War II television, sort of 1920s, 1930s, mechanical, electromechanical, analog electronic television. In a sense, that's already, there's no computers involved, but in a sense, it is vision because you could capture images and videos, you could modify them, you could encode them, you could transmit them, then you could reconstruct them. So without a computer, that was one component of it, one direction it came from. The computers at that time, again, the analog, like mechanical computers, analog computers, then electromechanical, computers, again, the 1920s, 1930s, they were already, but they were sort of elaborate calculators in a sense. They were used to solve mathematical problems like aiming a battleship gun or doing math for, let's say, accounting company. Things like that. So that was the other direction. And then the third direction was just understanding how animal vision and human vision works, visual behaviors of different living organisms and visual perception in humans. And all of this started coming together in 1950s and 1960s into actually trying to apply algorithms to captured images and trying to make sense of captured images in order to solve behavioral or robotics problems or do operations on images using computers. So that's where it began.
And okay. Obviously, the work of Fei-Fei Li at the Stanford University was absolutely vital for developing computer vision, right, with the ImageNet.
Yes. But we're talking much more recent times. We're talking much, much more recent times. So we're talking already pretty much 21st century.
Yes. And in your eyes, in terms of contemporary computer visions, what are the most groundbreaking technologies which allowed machines to capture the reality the way we are used today? So maybe most recent technologies, if you go into the 21st century.
Yeah, it's hard to name just one because there was really an explosion of creativity and explosion of new algorithms, new ideas, new ways of doing things, ways of doing new things that were not possible before in the last decade or so. If you think about the convolutional neural networks, yeah, or AlexNet and such, that was a bit over a decade ago. Then convolutional autoencoders, Deep Dream, GANs, style transfer, transformers. That was first for language, but visual transformers came about. 2020, I think it was. Yeah. So that was already 4 years ago, but that's pretty recent. Stable diffusion is even more recent. Segment anything is even more recent. And it's 2023. The most exciting, very recent one is Florence 2, because that's such an easy to work with, not really huge networks as we came to kind of expect of large vision language models in the last 3-4 years. So more like two.
Maybe can you talk a little bit about data capabilities and abilities prior one starts modeling? Because, you know, there's this perception you must have a very vast quantity of labeled data, yes, right? So yes, this is how it starts at large models. But I'm very curious. So maybe you explain this piece. And then, can we really generate fantastic success with small data? So this would be very interesting to me.
That's an excellent question. It will take me a minute to answer. So maybe
please
bear with me on that one. So for the listeners, of course, Anastasia, you may know this very well, but for the sake of the listeners, I want to start a little bit back and explain that there are really two kinds of image data, the labeled data and the unlabeled data. Unlabeled data is just the data collected with a camera or by any other means, just digital images, digital videos that a human did not go and mark what is what, which object is what, which scene is what, did not. So you can caption an image, describe the image entirely. You can put a bounding box or a contour around a certain object and annotate that. You can track objects across frames if it's a video. You can do a lot of other stuff. But that requires a human to generate labels or annotations. Annotations is a more general term, but most of the time people say them interchangeably. So that's annotated or labeled data. That's much more expensive and much more rare than unlabeled data. Unlabeled data, you can have a ton of it. And and if the data is scraped off of the internet, sometimes people use, like, there are databases like Lion, which are enormously large, but most of the labels there, so they're not very well curated. And I hope the people who compiled Lion 5B don't take offense with it. But it's an enormous asset in the terms of images, but it's not very well curated. So sometimes caption or label does not really match the image very well, or sometimes the images are not what you would expect, or some of the images there may be not safe for work. Let's put it this way. But big picture is it's much harder and much more expensive to have labeled data than unlabeled data. Yeah. So a lot of effort goes into making the networks able to learn on unlabeled data, or at least initially learn on unlabeled data. So this is called unsupervised learning. Because supervised learning, that means you have a teaching signal, you have the label that was generated by another human. Now, there is a closely related kind, which is usually grouped with distillation, where the labels are not, like network distillation, where the labels were generated not by a human, but by another network, which is already pre-trained, or which is a larger, better network, so you can generate so-called pseudo labels. That is also valid. But again, returning to the big picture, you usually have a lot of unlabeled data, and then some data you may have labeled because you hired a labeler or you found a labeled data set somewhere. But especially in the industry, your data is specific to your use case, so it comes, of course, unlabeled, and then you need to make a lot of effort to have it labeled properly, and sometimes it requires an expert, so that's hard and that's expensive. So as Anastasia said in her question, the main effort is to get the networks to act upon as little data as possible. And so the currently most effective way to do so is to use pre-trained transformers or pre-trained foundation models, because they have been already trained on a large labeled data set that big companies usually can afford. They do have those data sets that usually they curate themselves. They are taking care that these networks are being trained on very diverse data, which is really important, not just on the data that for your specific use case, but on a very diverse data, very well sampled, well balanced data, as much as possible. Again, not perfect, but as much as possible. And these are usually very large networks. Well, again, Florence 2 that I mentioned is not as large as some other ones, but not nearly as large as some other ones, but you pre-train on this general data, and then you can apply those networks on your specific data with the hopes that it would work on that specific data without further tuning. Because if you have very little data, you cannot train on this very little data. Now, there are tricks. I don't want to go into this, not to bore our listeners to death, but there are ways to make the networks, these foundation models, work much better, even when you give them very little data. But and this is something we, Acadium, the company where I lead the data science team, we work on this actually a lot because we work with industrial companies, and they, of course, don't have, let's say if you have some kind of defect in your manufacturing process, you don't have 1,000 examples of a defect. Sometimes you have one or two. So you need to be able to work with that. And this is our, I mean, almost bread and butter. Like that's what we do.
I mean, transformers, this is really such a groundbreaking innovation for the whole industry in language and in images, right? And of course, you mentioned GANs previously, so generative adversarial networks. This is tremendously interesting, of course. And then you mentioned hiring an expert or labeler. And of course, sometimes we are talking about very deep industrial expertise, like you are in healthcare, you understand radiology, you understand certain types of tumors. But sometimes people just hire people to sit down and just be patient and just label and label. And those companies hiring those people might sometimes go to China or Venezuela to get their data sets described and labeled. Have you ever encountered such situations where a customers outsource labeling to different geographies?
Yes. Yes. Both. I've encountered. And not just, well, in radiology. Yes, I've encountered that. But more generally, I've encountered this a lot in different contexts and outsourced to different countries by different labeling companies, or rarely by sometimes by client themselves.
Yeah.
I've also seen many machine learning companies use their own personnel to label data, which is awfully inefficient and somewhat demoralizing to the personnel. So
yeah,
we avoid doing that. Massive amount. Here is an important point, and you mentioned Fei Fei Li. The important thing is that these need for massive amount of labeled data to for your specific use case, that was really the traditional way of doing things until the advent of pre-trained transformer based large vision language model, large multimodal models. So in the previous generation, let's say between 2012-ish and 2022-ish, like that decade, people were training convolutional neural networks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And to train those, you need a lot of labeled data to train them to detect things, to segment things, to track things if you use feature-based tracker. To do all of these things, you need a massive amount of labeled data specific to your use case and specific to your categories or classes of objects that you're interested in. And that's the great breakthrough with the pre-trained foundation models, that now you can get away with much less labeled data for your specific client, for your specific use case. Because hiring external labelers or trying to label it in-house, it's very lengthy process. It's very costly process in some cases. The quality may vary. If you want to do it cheaper, the quality is right. lower. There's always like lead-in time as the labelers there figure out how to do the task right, even if you give them detailed instructions on how to do this. That gave rise to a lot of use cases that were not economically made sense for, not economically viable for artificial intelligence machine learning companies to tackle. This is changing now. So yeah. this is an important wave that not just our company, but many companies are, I wouldn't say riding this wave, because we have more fundamental stuff that we research and where we're developing. But this is one thing that makes a lot more use cases actually possible to address yes. industrial computer vision.
So, and Dmitry, I'm yeah. curious, just in your eyes and from your practice, what is the most complex area or industry for computer vision to, let's say, truly... I understand, for example, a remote maintenance of some machines,
that
right?
That too,
this
yes.
is, of course, big, but maybe I'm wrong. So if you have like a factory environment, so the factory environments of the machines are positioned in a certain way. So sometimes they move if we are having robots, but mostly it's kind of a controlled environment. If we have, for example, self-driving vehicles, so the environment is less controlled because there are so many variables coming from just the noisiness of and messiness of life itself. Are self-driving cars the most, let's say, complicated use case for computer vision, or what is it in your eyes?
So autonomy, yes, self-driving, autonomous robotics, cobots, all yeah. of this whole area that requires interacting, and you're absolutely right. You're spot on. The interacting with a dynamic environment, interacting with a weakly constrained environment that can change, that can have many different things happening. That's the hardest part.
Right. Maybe can you define cobots for my audience? Because probably people are not aware what cobots are.
It's sort of a colloquial name for collaborative robots that work yeah. with humans and around humans. At least this is how it's used most of this is how the word is used most of the time.
Yeah. And what is in your eyes the future of cobots, autonomous machines being cars or just, you know, moving robots interacting with other machines and with humans?
Yes.
So what would be, let's say, the next 5 years if we look into the future, how would those technology evolve when it comes to computer vision?
This is an excellent question, and I wish I had a future predictor
yeah,
network that was very accurate.
I would love to have a crystal ball myself.
Yeah. This is the area that is extremely active nowadays and will be extremely active in 5 years, because this is not something that can be solved overnight. There will be a lot of these breakthroughs and a lot of the incremental quantitative and qualitative improvements that eventually will allow the machines to work well with humans, to help humans, to work with humans, to work with other machines, make humans' workplace more interesting, safer. Because yeah. I mean, it's no fun for a human to just work the production line. It's
yeah.
much more interesting to train a robot or to to work with a sentient machine so that machine can do the hard and the tedious component and of the work, and their attention is not focused on one thing. They can attend to many things at once. So if yeah. they're moving apart, they will not kind of miss that there's someone standing behind them. They yeah. not they're not like humans. Their attention does not have to be fixed in one spot and one spot only. They don't get distracted. They don't kind of get lost in their own thought. Then all of that, like, they don't tend to cut corners in terms of safety. It's gonna be a much safer, much more productive, much more creative environment for humans, because that would allow the humans to do much more creative, much more interesting
work. Stuff. Yeah. And how, in your eyes, so I know you are a huge expert in multimodal AI, so how will multimodal AIs improve computer vision in your eyes?
Oh, it already is. So one thing that I mentioned is that you're using foundation models, using multimodal AI, you can solve use cases which are not economic to solve traditional way. You can do completely new things. You can literally talk to your network, talk to your AI, which was previously impossible. And that was almost I wouldn't say holy grail, but one of the key goals of AI in general and computer vision, specifically to be able to have this explainability, people call it explainable yeah. AI or interactive AI, where you can ask your network why it thinks what it thinks, or why it says what it says, or why it does what it does, because that was impossible. If you remember, between 2015 and 2020, I think there was a DARPA program, that DARPA explainable AI program.
Yes,
which was really, it was ahead
it
of
was
its
good.
Time.
Absolutely, but, absolutely. Yeah. I loved it. DARPA, by the way, this is an IND branch of the Ministry of Defense in the United States, and they did wonderful things for AI and robotics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and their papers, they could be downloaded. And this is actually a fantastic piece of research. In terms of XAI, I'm very frustrated altogether because, you know, the majority of research is really on behalf of system capabilities, but not on behalf of explainability and transparency and safety. And of course, you know, capabilities is where the money is.
Yes.
And I always wonder how people could be incentivized to think carefully about XAI, transparency, and just safety, right?
Yes, this is what we think, and this is part of one of the components of what we do at Acadium and at Temasek, like our parent company. And explainability is something I also worked to some extent on, or to a significant extent on, even before I joined Acadium, among other things. Specifically for foundation models or large vision language models that emerged in the last few years. I mean, people talk a lot or are afraid a lot of them being able to hallucinate, or their propensity rather to hallucinate or to see things that are not there. This can be handled very efficiently with explainability as well. And people were trying to do this with other approaches, which with simpler approaches, even on the convolutional networks, on the older networks. But you couldn't really talk or interact with them nearly in the same way you can with the foundation models. And Yeah, I don't want to get too technical, but really, this is a completely new realm of capabilities that the foundation models afford in a sense of interactivity. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. And, you know, I just, so I will ask this question and then I will round up. You know, so this explainability, so people believe it's tremendously important for humans to understand those deep neural networks, multi-layered networks. So who knows what is going on there. But I'm thinking recently, it's quite important machines to understand other machines. Because, you know,
yes,
when the workforce moves into automation more and more because we just lack, let's say, adults to work on those factory floors and in logistics and transportations and whatever. So we require machines to have an understanding. And I wonder whether this explainability research will influence a machine-to-machine communication as much as it does, let's say, general AI and trust of humans into AI systems?
This is an excellent, excellent question. That's a very, very deep question. This domain is just now starting. There isn't much like practical things developed in this domain yet, but probably next 5-10 years we will see a large effort in this domain. So your prediction, your prophecy, yeah, that's I strongly encourage the listeners to listen to that, because that whoever is now in high school or in their undergrad, that would be the domain that will be extremely active and extremely interesting in the next 5, 10, 15 years. I think so, yeah.
Absolutely. I would love anyone who is somehow engaged into thinking along those lines to reach out and to share papers, links, interesting videos about the domain. Really just hugely interested in it. And Dmitry, I would just ask the last question. And of course, we could spend another podcast talking about trust and ethics. So I reside in Europe, and Europeans are more cautious than maybe many Chinese or Americans even in regard of the ethics to deploy computer vision models, especially facial recognition. So what do you perceive in the industry? How is this ethic discussion influence the development from one side and then the deployment from the other side of computer vision technologies?
This is, again, an excellent question, and I'll probably take a minute or two to answer that. So first of all, full disclosure, I never touch politics. I'm not involved in politics in any way. I don't do politics. I'm a scientist and a developer. I'm not a politician. I have no political opinion. I have no interest in politics. I don't touch that. So what you want of your AI is the same thing that you want from your children. You want them to be fair, you want them to be smart, you want them to not be closed-minded and bigoted, you want them to be open-minded, to be fair. You want the same of AIs as you want from your children, or I want from my children. It's AIs are spiritually our children, not genetically, of course, but spiritually, because we train them, we give them upbringing, we teach them right and wrong. And don't get me wrong, the most networks, even foundation models, they don't have a concept of right and wrong. And I've mentioned this in a previous blog as well. They don't have the notion of cause and consequence. Everything they know from pictures and from written word. They don't they don't learn the consequence of their actions in real life. They have no faculty, no capacity of so doing. They don't have anything even remotely homologous or equivalent to our limbic system or any.
In consciousness.
As a limbic system, yeah, as be it a fish or a human. So even a goldfish, they have positive and negative learning, sort of. You can use or in real life, if they can learn to associate something with a reward or something with a being bitten. So and that requires that's not something that current neural networks have. They don't have the knowledge of good and bad. It is our duty as developers to make sure they do. Like, I'll give you one example. So so you need to detect for certain industrial use cases, you need to detect hands, gloved hands or ungloved hands, depends on the requirements of that particular use case and that particular workplace. It is extremely important to balance and account for all skin tones.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it will detect a different skin tone as a glove. Trust me on that one.
Yeah.
No, that's just one example. You need to think in human terms. You need to be not closed-minded, not bigoted, not kind of that's, and I can give these examples until tomorrow. I mean, we'll run out of time, but
yeah, no, but this is totally correct. I mean, this is not about AIs being evil or great. It's about how we utilize them. And even within Europe, for example, when it comes to applications like facial recognition, and of course AI can recognize faces, full stop, right? But some countries are fine with that, and some countries, so this are completely unthinkable to deploy anything like that across the streets, for underground trains, etc., even at the airports, right? So this is an interesting one, and ethics are very serious matter. They are with us to stay. We just need to carefully think about human-centric design at the end. So take your example with the gloves, right? And this is what a child can recognize immediately. Is it a glove or is it a hand, right?
Yeah.
And AIs, they can't. They need instructions.
Correct.
Absolutely. Dmitry, it was really lovely to see you again and to talk to you. Really, best of luck.
Thank you.
I mean, I love talking to you. You are one of those deep thinkers and practitioners, and we need more of you. Actually, being a data scientist has never been that exciting in my eyes. So, and
it
I wish that next generations of boys and girls enter your profession and contribute to transparent, safe, great, and highly deployable and scalable AI. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anastasia. It's a great pleasure to talk with you.
And that was my conversation with Dmitry Fischer. Romy, Robby, and the Secrets of Sleep. So the first Romy and Robby adventures are on Amazon. And I encourage you to visit my website, www.romyandrobby.ai. If you sign up for the newsletter, you will be involved into the updates on the creation of the second book of Romy and Robby series. And before we meet again next week, please invite more people on the journey of AI and talk to them about what you learned. I am very much into increasing technology understanding in people around us, because without our voices, developing beneficial and transparent AI will prove difficult. So goodbye for now, and see you next week.